I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
And a better explanation of the writing process I've never heard. Thank you, Curly. Hi, I'm Spider Robinson, and it's no accident that my name is an anagram for Born So Inspired. You've become hopelessly entangled in Spider on the web number 45, a user-supported oddcast from the home for the terminally confused, being brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. Let's get this show on the road. Steve Wiest is a trombonist, composer, arranger who used to blow for Maynard Ferguson. His secret identity is associate professor in the Jazz Studies Division of the College of Music at the University of North Texas. He is also a pleased reader of Variable Star, my collaboration with Robert A. Heinlein, and to express his pleasure, he recently sent me a copy of his latest CD, Excalibur, so I'm presuming he won't object if I podcast a track from it. It's called The Silver Spin, and what Steve has to say about it in his liner notes explains why I picked it tonight. Steve writes, "This piece is written for my wife, Carmen. The title comes from the fact that no matter how many negative thoughts I bring to the table, she unerringly finds a silver lining, or, as I describe it, puts a silver spin on it. For this and many other reasons, I am eternally grateful to her. Compositionally, this piece takes many elements from two of the most beautiful works in the large jazz ensemble repertoire, Brookmeyer's First Love Song and Thad's To You. The main melody of this chart has an interesting history. The notes come from the factory set ringer tones on my cell phone. When I first got the phone, nobody had the number but my wife. So when it rang, I knew it must be my sweetie." Insert aww sound here. Luckily, the chime-type nature of the ringer lent itself to a nice melody. Who says cell phones can't be romantic? Well, thank you, Steve. That's what you and Carmen are doing here tonight. Earlier today, I had a major disappointment I won't bore you with, but at the end of her own long, busy day, Jeannie managed to find a way, as always, to put a silver spin on it. So this podcast is dedicated to her with love, like all the rest of them. Now here's the Steve Wiest Big Band. Thank you. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Jeannie. I have wonderful news for you all. My latest novel, Very Hard Choices, has managed to sneak out of the warehouse a little bit ahead of schedule and is already in bookstores everywhere. So you can race right out and get a copy. And don't forget, as always, if you would like your copy signed or personalized by me, the author, all you gotta do is contact White Dwarf Books in Vancouver, whose URL is www.deadwrite.com/wd.html. That's www.deadwrite.com/wd.html. They'll be happy to sell you a signed or personalized copy at no extra charge, and they've got mailing addresses on both sides of the border, so there's no customs bullshit. Without further ado, we resume our reading of Very Hard Choices, where I left off last time with Chapter 8. Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, Coveney Island, British Columbia, Canada. The downside of talking with a telepath, of course, is that he knows when you've stopped being out of breath. Long before I wanted to be, I was on my feet and following Xandor Zutanigo home. I divided my attention between careful observation of where I was putting my feet and equally careful assessment of the pain in my right upper chest. I was already pretty sure I was okay, but the bad news can arrive as much as half an hour after the trauma sometimes. And once there was no cause, I reached for a cup of coffee and along went. Well, the division of my attention was not really 50-50. More like 40-40. A good 20% of my mind, despite everything I could do to censor it, insisted on marveling at Zooty's body. He was barefoot to his scalp, wearing only an oversized wristwatch on his left wrist. When I'd roomed with him back in the late 60s, I had on rare occasion seen him without a shirt or without pants, though never entirely naked, and he'd basically been a pile of bread dough in the approximate size and shape of a walrus. A couple of years ago, when I'd seen him for the first time since those days, he'd been the same size and shape, and so I had assumed the same body under his clothes. Wrong. There wasn't a matter of muscle definition. He was still padded, but not with flab. He was in the same kind of shape Nico was now. It was obvious from the way he moved and carried himself. I reminded myself he had been living alone in the wilderness for an indeterminate number of years. And although I was looking mostly at his back, I could still clearly see in my mind's eye his chest and groin. Third nipples are not that rare, but they almost always occur near one of the standard ones. Zooty's was smack dab in the middle of his nearly hairless chest, just above an imaginary line connecting the other two. And he was hung like Rocco Siffredi, which started me thinking for the first time in decades of Oksana Becher. And she was an extremely awkward thing to think about in the close vicinity of Xandor Zutanigo for at least two reasons, because I was fairly sure the memories must be hurting him, and because I knew for certain they were shaming me.
"Go ahead," he called back over his shoulder. "I let go of her long ago, and forgave you way before that."
Feeling my ears get hot, I let the memories return. Smelly, as everyone called Zooty back then, put the administration of William Joseph College in a quandary. Complaints about his eye-watering reek and world-class weirdness, even in the context of the 60s, were continuous and angry from students, faculty, and staff. But such was his reputation in the world of mathematics that he raised the school a whole couple of notches in international prestige all by himself, simply by attending an occasional class there and choosing its professors and grad students to discuss his work with once in a while. Professors from other schools and occasional students would sometimes come long distances just to talk with someone who had talked with Smelly. That, at least, was how I explained the administration's extraordinary tolerance level to myself at the time. It wasn't until later that I learned the Zutanigo family had given old Billy Joe Yu a large enough endowment for a new gymnasium and a celebrity coach to run it, on the condition that young Xandor not be sent or encouraged to go home again for at least 4 years. The school was motivated to put up with a few problems. I myself solved one of the administration's biggest problems for them by agreeing to room with Smelly. Down the road, their gratitude would have a lot to do with my being able to end my college career with a bachelor's degree rather than a prison record. He solved another problem for them by quietly agreeing to eat his meals after everyone else was done. Smelly could not be reasoned with on the subject of his monstrous body odor. He would not discuss it at all, rationally or otherwise, but he was willing to at least listen to reason when absolutely necessary. The cafeteria staff didn't mind remaining to serve him because he actually got them home faster. Almost nobody else ever loitered after their meal once Smelly arrived. Nor did he necessarily always eat alone. I frequently shared a meal with him simply because I was late to everything. A bare handful of others had the same quirk. And there were even one or two so fiercely committed to personal weird behavior of their own, this was the 60s, remember, that they felt obliged to pretend they didn't notice anything odd about Smelly. So there were witnesses when Oksana Bescher appeared across the cafeteria table from him one afternoon, cleared her throat, and asked if this seat were taken. He blushed and nodded. She sat, and they ate their lunches together in perfect silence. Then they got up and left together in silence, not touching, but side by side. The story was so good, one witness would have been enough. It was all over campus by dinner time. Because they were perfect for each other.
"It's a battle of the giants, like Godzilla versus Rodan," Slinky John put it. "Dueling freaks."
As a child, Oksana had dived into a lake somewhere and shattered her nose on an unseen rock. They rebuilt it, of course, but she had managed to destroy her sense of smell, and for that they could do nothing. She was perfect for Zooty. It was impossible to say which was the more ridiculous. He looked and sounded like Baby Huey. Her overpronounced overbite and lisp and absurdly thick finger and toenails made her look and sound like Bugs Bunny with an earectomy. Xandor was tall, Oksana was short. He was wide, she was thin. He was as heavy as his smell, she was as insubstantial as her self-opinion. Smelly could be detected approaching from a city block away. Nobody but him was ever likely to get close enough to her to notice what, if anything, Oxy smelled like. Each was cursed with an almost unmeasurably high IQ and a freak intellectual gift. Mathematics, in his case, poetry in hers. You tell me which had drawn the short straw there. He was a perfect and total social failure as a man, she as a woman. Put them side by side, and their individual weirdness was not doubled but squared. As a couple, they'd have made a cat laugh. They didn't appear to notice the stifled grins. They began eating lunch together most days. Perhaps they felt the pressure of everyone else's amused expectations. Within a week or so, they were observed to take walks together, and the gossip mill exploded in laughter and jeers. I've worked hard to retain my chosen self-image as a pretty nice guy, and I really did feel an almost painful degree of empathy with both of them, having been an outcast all my own life, and even I am profoundly ashamed of what I thought of them as a couple. I liked them both, wished them both well, and wanted to howl with laughter every time I saw them together. I don't even want to imagine what Zooty must have been picking up from everyone else he walked past. I just wish I could wash my own mind out with soap, retroactively. Someone once said, regret is the sharpest pain. Oxy became part of our shared life as roommates with no discussion at all. I hardly ever saw them together, actually, and then usually from a distance. Whenever I did encounter her, with or without Zooty, she was friendly enough, but even less talkative than he was. I thought of offering to leave the room to them until curfew on Friday or Saturday nights, as some roommates did for one another, but I never actually worked up enough nerve to raise the subject, and Smelly never asked, so as far as I know, Oxy never saw the inside of our room. If their relationship was ever consummated, it must have taken place off campus somewhere. So did my own all-too-rare consummations that year. Getting a Catholic girl to agree to sneak into your dorm room was hard enough. Getting one to sneak into that room was out of the question. This all occurred during a historical period in which, for reasons I despair of explaining, university students, not just in Catholic colleges like Billy Joe, but everywhere, lived in sexually segregated quarters with absolutely no parietal hours ever. I can still recall the day in my final year when our floor RA called a meeting to tell us the stunning news that the school was considering instituting co-ed visiting hours, quote, periodically, unquote. Slinky John brought the house down by calling out,
"Yeah, I knew it, every 28 days.
Everyone on campus, of course, assumed the smelly-oxy relationship had been consummated, and most had theories as to where and exactly how. Some of them were quite imaginative, and a few were actually funny. Not until Michael Jackson married Lisa Marie Presley would I again hear any couple's sex life speculated on with such avid distaste. Apparently, we never really do get much less cruel than we were in the playground. Not even in a Catholic college, less than 6 months before what would come to be known as the Summer of Love. I'm including myself in that judgment. I had spent most of my life, pretty much right up until the day I left for college, getting my ass kicked on a regular basis and being ridiculed in between for being too smart, too skinny, too sensitive, too sarcastic, too scared, sometimes just for being handy. I knew what it was like to be an outcast, a figure of fun. But even I, who knew just how bad it felt, was not immune to the shameful human pleasure of making myself feel bigger by making someone else seem smaller. Only in my mind, at least. I was quite sure I hid my secret amusement so well that neither suspected its existence. I took pains to treat Oxy the same way I took pains to treat Smelly, with the same respect I would anyone else, just as if I had it. But inside, I got a big kick out of him. I tripped over a rock as I stumbled behind him through the Coveney Island undergrowth, banged my knee when I went down, and accepted the bright pain as long overdue penance. A Catholic upbringing is awfully, awfully hard to shake. Now, of course, I burned, knowing that back then Zooty had known perfectly well just what a hypocritical, condescending, smug, arrogant jackass I really was inside. The same respect I had pretended to pay him, he had paid me by not busting me for it. Zooty's arm, astonishingly strong, helped me to my feet. We were out of the wind and away from the shore by now. He didn't have to raise his voice to be heard.
There wasn't anything you could have done differently if you had known. You can't apologize for finding something funny. It isn't an act of the will. All you can do is be polite about it, and you were. I found just about everyone on that campus, yes, including you, hilarious to the point of heartbreak. I also found the majority of you horrifying to the point of hysteria. It wasn't easy to conceal either one sometimes, even with the overwhelming advantage that you people could only see what was shown and hear what was said.
I thought about that as the pain in my knee dropped back to bearability.
You did okay.
I know. So did you, is my point, all things considered.
You're welcome.
He turned and continued on his way. I felt a weight leave me. I followed him, my thoughts turning now to how it had all ended. I wished they wouldn't, but there was no point trying to stop them. Smelly and Oxy never attended any school social events, either before or after they met. They were just seen around the campus together, usually in some out-of-the-way corner, and then snickered about behind their backs. A couple of girls who knew Oksana privately asked me what Zooty was really like, and in return I tried to pump them for information about her, but we really didn't have a lot to trade, and nothing very interesting on either side. Before her hookup with Smelly, Oxy had not been considered particularly eccentric, at least by the standards of 60s college students, just funny-looking. The word on her had been, "Brilliant poet, here on full scholarship, little flaky." She was rumored to spend her summers at Duke University in North Carolina, being tested for some sort of mild ESP ability at the famous Institute J.B. Ryan had founded there. But just what sort of ESP wasn't clear. It wasn't something she talked about. Not one of the interesting ones, like reading minds or making things float, anyway. Remote seeing, maybe, or guessing the weather. Of far more interest, as far as I was concerned, was her poetry. Out of roughly 100 English majors on campus willing to publicly express opinions about poetry, about 95 were willing to admit they found hers impenetrable, and 5 worshipped her to the point of awe so incoherent they couldn't explain it to anyone else. I was among the former group, rather to my own surprise. I liked weird, exotic, avant-garde stuff, prided myself on it, but hers was just out there. Most often, I simply couldn't grasp what she'd been trying to accomplish well enough to hazard a guess as to how well she'd succeeded. I guess that's my prejudice with art. I don't care what set of rules the artist used, as long as I'm given a fighting chance to guess what they were. I like to feel I could tell if he made a mistake. By the time that school year ended, I had probably had fewer than a dozen conversations with her, none of them long, none about anything of substance. The most personal thing I learned about her was that she could barely taste anything. It turns out the sense of smell is essential to the sense of taste. Try telling strawberry ice cream from vanilla blindfolded and holding your nose. I always meant to ask her about her poetry, but never found a polite way to say, I find your work impenetrable. Can you get me started? I meant to ask about the ESP stuff, but never found a polite way to ask, do you really believe in that crap? I meant to ask her about her childhood in the Ukraine, but never found a polite way to ask, so what was Mordor like? Above all, from the moment she and Zudi first connected, I wondered, just like everyone else on campus, how in the hell she could possibly stand to be near anyone who stank so, even if she herself couldn't detect it. But I doubt there is a polite way to ask that. I remember that twice before the end of that semester, I managed to get her alone with the intention of working the conversation around to Zudi's unique personal hygiene standards. I wondered if she might be able to shed any light on exactly what his problem with bathing was. Each time, she reacted the same way. She didn't know what I was talking about. She seemed honestly unaware there was anything wrong with the way he smelled. The first time, she thought I was making an odd joke. The second time, she got mad and I had to apologize. I didn't dislike her, but I didn't especially like her, either. I couldn't connect with her. Didn't get her. I couldn't seem to find a topic of conversation we both cared about, except Zudi, and she didn't like to talk about him. Most people I'd known who were in love could not be stopped from talking about their beloved, but I guess maybe poets were different. I take it back. There was one topic we did nearly discuss until we realized how it was going to turn out and backed away by mutual agreement, to keep the peace, which was ironic because the topic was war. She supported the war in Vietnam. Reading accounts of the 60s today, it's easy to get the impression that, after some initial confusion, my entire generation united in opposition to that war and worked arm in arm to end it, chanting, "Give peace a chance," as one. That's revisionist horseshit. Less than 10% of Billy Joe's student body opposed the war when I arrived in 1966, and I doubt the figure ever rose higher than 30% while I was there, until the U.S. pulled out and our numbers doubled overnight retroactively. They've been climbing ever since. Try looking today for someone my age who will admit that he supported the war, voted for Nixon, went short-haired and beardless, abstained from psychedelics, or cheered when anti-war protesters got the shit kicked out of them by right-wing thugs. I haven't found one in decades. All I can tell you is, back then they were in the overwhelming majority on my campus. Perhaps they all died of lameness. But if I stand for anything at all, it's tolerance. So, Oksana was not the only friend with whom I tacitly agreed not to discuss the war. A lot of my fellow hippies enjoyed arguing with the straights, because it was so easy. I was more the kind who believed I made my best contribution to the discussion by having better vibes than the pro-war people. And she seemed to believe in the same tactics on her side. There was never a trace of bad feeling between us. I just never warmed to her, or she to me. Our senses of humor didn't match. She always smiled when I made a joke, but clearly only from politeness, and when she made one, I usually didn't notice she had until minutes or hours later. She had a knack for telling me things about myself I didn't want to know, and I couldn't even get irritated because she never did it in an aggressive way, but merely offered all too astute observations. It was only partly because I never saw her without a science fiction paperback in her backpack, she wore a backpack, that I started thinking of her in my head as part Martian.
I told her that, Zudi told me now. It made her laugh hard.
I thought about it. I'm glad to know I made her laugh hard. I used to try.
You succeeded more often than you knew.
We had reached his home. A big heap of rock at the edge of the water, heavily overgrown with scrub vegetation and moss, over on the far side of the island where no sea landing was possible. He lifted his left hand, and a section of the rock face developed a vertical crack and swung out on hinges, vegetation and all. I keep forgetting that nowadays they can pretty much pack a full-service computer, phone, and remote control into a watch no bigger than the one he wore. It began to dawn on me that Zudi might be about as naked and defenseless as a cartoon superhero. Who knew what weapons were trained on me now?
None, he said. You're with me.
He went inside. To keep being with him, I did too. I was half expecting to walk into a fully modern luxury apartment with hardwood floors, indirect lighting, all the latest high-tech appliances and entertainment dispensers, and a two-car bat cave in the basement. What I found was quite different, but I had to admit it was by far the best upholstered and appointed cave I had ever seen. Not to mention the neatest bachelor's quarters I'd ever seen. Mine were a disaster area by comparison. He handed me a bath towel.
Give me your clothes. I'll rinse and dry them.
I nodded. I was dripping on his floor, and overdressed. Temperature and humidity were not cave-like at all, but ideal for naked humans. The floor was stone, but somehow warm enough for bare feet without feeling heated. Adequate lighting with the new hyper-efficient bulbs. Ceiling just a bit low for a man of my height, which, despite advancing years, is so far still 186 centimeters, or 6'1". I saw the room's heat sources, a pair of the same highly efficient super-brand electric gas radiators that I used myself at home. I could just barely smell his dinner, something with garlic, and nothing else. We were in a large kitchen-dining-room-living-room space, and directly ahead of us was a corridor running the length of the place with four doors off it. I guessed the total square footage of the place to be a little more than half that of my own cottage. There was a minimum of furniture in the living room area to my right, just two chairs and a coffee table made of a slab of rock on which lay a power book and an assortment of remotes, but before them were three very large flat-screen monitors, each with its own 8-core Mac Pro workstation, one of those Apple TV gadgets I'd been lusting for, and a couple of 8-speaker towers that looked capable of vaporizing us and sending our constituent molecules back through time. I didn't see any wires anywhere, except a few power cords.
"Don't ask," he said,
so I didn't. I remembered that Zudi had come for money. Evidently, his family had found a way to leave some of it to a scion who did not legally exist. That pretty much exhausted the high-tech in the place, though. The kitchen was simple, basic, no gourmet gear at all. Small electric two-burner stove with tiny oven, small microwave, water pumped from a cistern heated in a standard tank. To my horror, I could see no coffee machine, or even a teapot, and I remembered that Zudi regarded caffeine as a poisonous substance. I'm a hardcore caffeined. At home, I have a Ura Scalavario I got third-hand. Push a single button, and 60 seconds later, you're drinking fresh-ground French press-style coffee. Every few days, you toss in a pound of beans and a few gallons of water and empty the used grounds hopper. I hoped I wouldn't be here too long.
"Relax," he said. "I have some and means to make it."
Without asking, he went to the kitchen end and started a pot of water boiling. After some rummaging in one of the harder-to-reach cabinets, he located coffee, sugar, and one of those little red plastic cones designed to hold a one-cup coffee filter above a cup.
"No cream."
"Fine." As the water heated, he said,
"Okay, sit down over there and go over it again, slowly this time. Visualize rather than summarize."
I sat in one of the chairs by the TV and reviewed in my mind everything that had happened from the moment Nika had pulled into my driveway until I had set to sea in the fiendish dinghy. He never interrupted. By the time I was done, I was drinking hot coffee. It was startlingly good for already ground coffee that was neither refrigerated nor vacuum-packed. The first comment he made after I finished my mental recap surprised me.
"Very impressive young man, your son,"
he said, sitting down across from me.
"Tears you up inside, being hated by him."
"Almost as bad as her death itself," I agreed. "That I'm getting past, slowly."
"You can't finish getting past it until he at least starts," he said.
I stared at him. Even back in college, he'd had a way of doing that, speaking a single short sentence that didn't really say anything you didn't already know exactly, but somehow got you looking at it from a fresh new angle. "And as long as he stays pissed at me, he doesn't have to start," I said.
"Oh, it isn't you he's pissed at. You're just the one he can reach."
"Jesus!" He'd done it again. "What should I do?" He smiled a bitter smile.
"You are asking me for advice on interpersonal relations?"
I looked him in the eye. "Yes," I said, and nodded. "Yes, Zudi, I am." Slowly, the bitterness leached out of the smile.
"Thank you."
"Thank you. What should I do?" He thought for a moment, and his smile broadened.
"Punch him in the mouth."
I nearly choked on my last sip of coffee.
"What?" "Think about it a while."
His smile went away.
"Another time. We're busy right now."
He was right. My problem with my son was chronic. Zudi's was acute. "Sorry," I said, "but you brought it up." He nodded.
"It's important."
And now we move on. Okay. I stopped and tried to organize my thoughts. Suddenly, I thought of a question I'd wanted to ask him ever since we'd met again a few years ago and he had confessed to being a mind reader. Zudi, can you ever send thoughts instead of just receiving them to someone receptive? He became a statue of himself. Was I offending him by suggesting he was a mental voyeur? I tried to explain. I need a lot of information from you, and it would save an awful lot of time if you could just give it to me in a data dump the way I just did to you. I'm just asking, I finished lamely. The sudden transformation in him was horrifying. He was not seeing me anymore. He was not there anymore. Wherever he was, the best thing you could hope for was a week's vacation in hell. I closed my eyes and shouted with both voice and mind,
I'm sorry, Zudi!
Just as suddenly, he was back.
Not your fault. Perfectly reasonable question.
All at once, I found myself recalling that on the day I'd met Zudi, more than 40 years ago, one of the very first thoughts that had gone through my head was, this man can forgive anything.
It just derailed the train of thought. Tesla resonance.
I nodded. Happens. He took a deep breath and let it out, then another. Then he rotated his head from side to side to crack his neck. I noticed for the first time his excellent posture.
Okay, he said finally. I'm going to tell you the story. I've only told it twice before, and not in years. And when I am done, you will understand why I am absolutely positive that I will never be able to directly touch another mind. But listen carefully, Russell. In order to make you understand that, I'm going to have to tell you the most terrible secret I know. One nobody else knows. Once I have, you'll be stuck with it forever, just like I am.
He locked eyes with me.
And it's really rotten. Are you willing to share that with me?
Absolutely. I never hesitated. This man had saved my life and Nika's and the lives of at least 4 strangers we never met by killing a monster with his mind in my living room in some way so ghastly it had cost him his self-respect and peace of mind for the past 2 years. If he needed to share a burden, I was there.
Thank you, he said.
His voice quivered just a bit. So did mine. You're welcome. He got up and made me a second cup of coffee. He used the time to organize his thoughts, so I shot up too and used mine to look his place over a little more closely. He'd obviously been here for years before dropping in on me. Just ferrying all this gear out here was a lot of work, and apparently he'd managed it both single-handed and undetected. A neat trick. Keeping the place supplied must be another neat trick. No wonder he was in such good shape. I forced my mind away from both puzzles for fear of distracting him with involuntary questions. The power book on the coffee table went into its screensaver mode, and Zudi used the same one I did, Electric Sheep. It produces random visual effects strikingly like what I used to see behind my eyelids while tripping on LSD-25 back in the 60s, bright and colorful and mathematically elegant and quite hypnotic. I was about to hear a story from the 60s. I stared at the screen and let the thought of tripping carry me back in memory. Zudi was handing me my clothes, still warm from the dryer, and a plastic container that held my belt, keys, lighter, and other pocket junk. When I wondered about my wallet, he gestured to where it and its contents were spread out on a counter to dry in the kitchen area. He was wearing gray Bermuda-type shorts himself now, which I thought very gracious, considering we were in his home. Wrong initials, I said as I dressed.
Beg pardon?
They warned us about dreaded acid flashbacks. Remember, I've waited eagerly for one ever since, and I've never had one in my life or met anyone who did. The dreaded flashbacks that have occurred, over and over, roughly every decade, aren't LSD. They're KIA and MIA. He sat back down.
And CIA.
I thought that was where this was going. He was silent for so long that I began to watch the electric sheep display again to silence my mind, lest I derail his train of thought again. Whether it helped, I couldn't say. Finally, he spoke.
Russell, I think I have to tell you why I've been holed up here for so long, ignoring you. Why what I did to Alan nearly 4 years ago tore me up as badly as it has. You think you want to know, and you really do need to know. If I do, I think you'll agree that I needed to tell you. But you won't thank me. You'll wish I hadn't. Wish I hadn't had to. Now you have to make a very hard choice. Whether to let me.
I sat and thought about that a while. You're my friend, I said then, and you know more about what's going on than I do. Do what you think you need to do. All right, before beginning Chapter 9, I will pause for a short musical interlude by one of the greatest composers and arrangers alive on the planet today, the great Carla Bley. There ought to be statues to Carla in every major city in America. I don't know why there aren't. This is Carla Bley and the Lost Chords with guest star Paolo Fresu on trumpet at the Teatro Olimpico in Vicenza, Italy on May 14th of 2007 with a short excerpt called Banana Quintet, Part 2. Carla kicks it off herself on piano, then hands it off to her longtime criminal associate Steve Swallow on bass. Thank you. I should have remembered to credit drummer Billy Drummond and tenor sax player Andy Shepherd with that. Now, the only way to get that particular live version is to become a member of www.dimeadozen.org, as I've spoken of many times in the past. However, there is a spiffy studio version of that tour called The Lost Chords Find Paolo Fresu. And if you go to Amazon.com and click on and dial in Carla Bley, that'll be the first one you see right up at the top of the list. It's an amazing album, and I highly recommend it. Carla also, by the way, has one of the most whimsical websites out there, designed by Karen Mantler, with drawings by David Cohen. It is at www.wattextrawatt.com. I better spell that. www.wattextrawatt.com/. That's Carla Bley's website, and I guarantee you an interesting time if you go there. And now we return to Very Hard Choices. Chapter 9, Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, Coveney Island, British Columbia, Canada. Those were the last words I spoke until Zudi had finished his story. It was quite obvious that telling it was hard for him. I didn't want to make it any harder. Whenever he stopped to search for words, I waited until he found them. He said,
"The last you saw of me and Oksana, at the end of that semester, we told you we were going to spend the summer together at ESP camp, a remote retreat in the woods somewhere in Maryland where we were going to be paid guinea pigs for a bunch of white coats from the psych department at Duke University. That's what we were told. Nobody mentioned any government involvement to us. The only initials we heard were ESP and PSI. We thought of it as a paid vacation in the country, and just possibly an approach to some way of learning to cope with my predicament. The last you heard of either of us was when you got back to William Joseph in September, and we weren't there, and all you could find out was that Oksana had been killed in a tragic hunting accident, and nobody knew where I was. You tried very hard to learn more, thank you for that, but there wasn't any more to learn, and after a while you came to the same conclusion everyone else had, that in my grief at losing her, I'd taken my own life. That was pretty close to the truth. I didn't kill myself, but I did get Oksy killed. And then, to stay alive, I had to kill my identity. Right, getting ahead of myself. Oksana was the one they were really interested in. They had been for years since she'd been in high school. Her gift wasn't as dangerous as mine, so she'd never learned to hide it. They'd finally gotten her to sit down for a week of testing during spring break, and the data suggested that she seemed to have a limited ability to influence probability somehow. Only on a very small scale, but if she was in the right frame of mind, she could roll sevens for as long as you liked, with your dice. She made enough in roulette winnings to pay for an entire semester before the Atlantic City Benevolent Association asked her nicely to stop playing there. This was way before we decided to make up for our degradation of the noble Native Americans by letting them milk gambling addicts. Atlantic City was pretty much it for the East Coast now that Havana was gone. After a few disastrous incidents in my childhood and a long talk with my grandmother, I'd never told anyone but her about my own ability, and I didn't plan to. I've always known how most people would react if they knew, and I didn't want to be feared. But I did want to spend the summer with Oksana, so I compromised. I used telepathy to fake just enough talent at guessing Ryan cards to make me an ESP suspect, too. If it turned out that anyone there actually knew anything about telepathy that I didn't, I thought perhaps I might just consider slowly coming out to him or her. I was at that age when hope doesn't take any effort at all. It started out great. The place was beautiful, a lodge beside a lake in the middle of nowhere that we had all to ourselves. White birch maple everywhere. Bullfrogs and a trillion crickets at night. Comfortable rooms, decent food, no TV, great library. Everyone on the staff was a decent person in a lab coat. Honest, earnest, academic. The other specials, as we were encouraged to call ourselves, were a fascinating crew ranging from utterly ordinary to crazy as a basketball bat. But we all got along well, despite our sometimes wildly incompatible quirks, because for most of us it was the first time we'd ever been in a group where we were not considered weird. It was a novel and pleasant experience, not automatically being the strangest person in the room. The work was interesting and not onerous. Then new directives came in from somewhere outside, and the direction of the research started changing subtly. A guy with a talent for clairvoyance who'd been trying to predict stock market or sports results would be tasked with predicting the outcome of a specific military operation in Southeast Asia instead. A woman with telekinetic ability would find herself being asked not to make marbles roll uphill, but to try and cause a guinea pig's heart to stop beating. A road company psychic like me would be asked not what card a man was looking at, but whether he was lying to me about it or not. And then one day Oksana was asked by her tester whether she thought she might be able to influence the probability of an individual uranium atom fissioning, and if so, from how far away? Could she, hypothetically, of course, prevent or discourage an atom bomb from going off? Or, say, encourage one far away to go off by itself? Or fail to? We talked quietly between ourselves that night, and we both began to have problems with our paranormal powers. Nothing as obvious as a strike, but our test scores started to trend downward. We also talked about sharing what we knew at the other specials. A few of us were strongly in favor of the Vietnam War. I was myself then. But not one of us was interested in learning to use our special talent to kill people. Especially not on a nuclear scale. But we were both nervous about taking that overt a step. Once released, the demon could not be put back in the box. If it was a government operation and they knew we doubted it, we could end up in very deep shit. We wanted to know how deep. We'd all seen the nominal director of the place, listened to him addresses from a stage, gotten memos from him, but he seemed a bit snobby, always kept his distance. I doubt anyone else remarked it, but he was the only person in the whole place who'd never come within 50 meters of me or any of us. Well, I was the only one capable of getting within 50 meters of him without being stopped, and one day I did. Then I ran all the way back to Oksana's room and got her to take a walk with me to one of the places I now knew was not bugged, and we began planning our escape. His mind was one of the scariest I'd ever encountered then, very much like I'd always imagined Mengele's mind must have been. But what really terrified me was the mind of the man who terrified him, the master he served and hated, a CIA senior agent who called himself Pitt and didn't offer a first name. If the director's mental picture of Agent Pitt was remotely accurate, I did not want to ever meet him. At Pitt's insistence, the director had placed surveillance devices all around the perimeter of the place, not just at the access points, but in the forest too, although he privately considered it a stupid waste of money and technology. It was very good technology for the time, CIA technology. It could not have been defeated by anyone but its designers, the techs who monitored and serviced it, the director who'd had it installed, or someone who'd been reading his mind. If you're privy to another man's secrets, if you're better informed than he thinks you are, it can give you the illusion that you're smarter than he is. You can get so used to everyone you meet considering your special talent to be unimaginable. When you finally encounter one of the rare minds that is capable of imagining it, it blindsides you. I forgot to be humble. I paid dearly for it. We gave it a few days, let our test scores come back up to baseline so we'd stop standing out. It must have made Pitt look even closer, realize we were getting ready to make our move. Zudi stopped for so long I started to think he'd reconsidered telling me the rest, and then enough longer that I started to wish he would if it was really that bad. Then he went on. Oksana was from a tiny little place in New York called Saranac Lake, so remote they had their own phone system. Her mom's phone number was LE27. You had to ask an operator to connect you. Oksana knew about living in the woods. She filled backpacks with what we would need to survive in the open for as long as a week. Anything we didn't have, I stole to order. It got to be kind of fun. Adventure. Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher outwitting Injun Joe. Finally, she said we were ready. That night, we went over the wall. It was a piece of cake. Almost an anticlimax. After all, I knew all the security procedures. Wrong. I knew all the security procedures the director knew about. All the ones Agent Pitt had told him about. But Pitt had no problem at all dealing with the concept of a telepathic opponent. A security system he had carefully not told the director about, a robot system with no mind for me to read, caught us just as we were becoming confident enough to talk to each other without whispering. She was leading. I think it read us as a single target. She said over her shoulder, "Xander, it's going to be so..." And then it shot her. With a rubber bullet, marketed as non-lethal, Agent Pitt didn't want to waste any assets, just stop them leaving. It was supposed to hit the target in the lower chest, knock the breath out of him. Oksana was very short. She took it in the larynx. She fell down on her back. I lay down with her, held her in my arms. She kicked her legs and died. Half a minute, maybe. That was very bad. Then it got a whole lot worse. Zudi got up abruptly.
He went to the kitchen end of the room and made more coffee. He moved slowly, deliberately, like a monk being mindful. When the cup was full, he carefully dunked a shot glass into it, then set the full shot glass aside and replaced its contents in my cup with brandy. He brought me the cup and the bottle of brandy, kept the shot glass for himself. I'd never seen him drink caffeine before. He'd always treated it the way some unfortunates have to treat peanuts. He'd once turned down a cup of decaf Nika offered him, saying they didn't decaffeinate it enough. I set the bottle down on the coffee table and made a toasting gesture. He responded, "Clink." We drank. He said, "I'd never been near anyone when they died before. Rich family. Sheltered life. In the movies, on TV, in books, everywhere, it's always the same. When people die, they die like a light going out. Or at worst, like a TV getting turned off. Zip! Shrink down to a single pixel. Gone. It's pretty to think so. Maybe even necessary. But it's not true. But, well, maybe it's true for those who die of sudden, catastrophic brain trauma. I don't know. Maybe it's even true for those whose death is the culmination of a slow, natural process of dissolution. But not for those who were killed. It wasn't for her, anyway. I know. I was there. Her breathing stopped. Her heart stopped. Her body died. Consciousness persisted. How much? Enough to feel pain. No loss. How long? A minute, an hour, a million years. Somewhere in that range. Oksana had faith. That helped her. A little. For a while. I'd never really been religious. At age 7, I already knew what the Catholic Church was trying to do to me. I just kept my head down and my mouth shut. But they got to her. Her parents were so overjoyed to get out of the Ukraine, they made sure she joined them in thanking God for the miracle. Like most good people, she took the good parts of her religion to heart and tried her best to resolve the contradictions. She called on that faith to sustain her, and it did help. Some. For a while. But Oxy wasn't an idiot. She felt herself going away into the darkness. Alone. Blind. Helpless. Terrified beyond all description. It was impossible not to wonder how, why, a loving God could leave one of his children in this state for 1 second, let alone a million years. No atheists in foxholes? My ass. No, you're wrong. No, it wasn't like that either. Think about it. All the near-death experience stories you've ever read were, by definition, recounted by someone who didn't die. Maybe that's what you experience just before your brain starts to die. I don't know. The ones I've read sound a lot like anesthetic dreams on an operating table. Bright light in your face, shadowy people all around you with benevolent intentions who look a little like your dead Uncle Phil. Yes, maybe the Buddhists are right. Maybe she was just heading for one of the Bardos, a place between incarnations. How can I know? To me, the Buddhist universe has always seemed cold, indifferent. Not much comfort in it. Life is suffering. Somehow they're okay with that. Oksana wasn't Buddhist. She just saw extinction coming. And she was scared shitless. Jesus stopped being plausible. She missed me so much. She cried out for me. That's how I know for absolute certain that I can't send. With my whole heart and brain and mind and soul, more than I wanted to keep living, I tried to shout back. I wanted to reach out and tell her, "I'm here. I'll always love you. You made me so happy. Let go now. If it can be done, I'll find you again." I tried harder than I ever had before to touch her mind the way everyone touched mine. I gave it everything I had, more, like a mother lifting an SUV off her child with one hand. Total failure. We were both screaming at the top of our minds. I heard her. She heard nothing. She started to crack. Zudi lifted the shot glass to his mouth, moistened his lips from it, sighed, emptied it with a gulp, knocking it back like raw whiskey, set the shot glass down on the table. You've read Daniel Dennett's Consciousness Explained? I know. Don't feel bad. His reasoning isn't hard to follow at all. It's just hard to wrap your mind around. Big surprise. I'll summarize as best I can without writing another book longer than his, anyway. Basically, Dennett says the Buddhists have it right. The self is an illusion.
consciousness is just a cover story. There is no you, really, but your body finds it extremely useful to pretend there is. Its various systems, organs, glands, nerves, muscles, blood, gonads, are what the Buddhists call dependently co-arising. They all have to be there working in concert for any of them to exist at all. The illusion that there is a tiny little man sitting in a control room in the middle of your brain coordinating things by looking at a monitor screen and deciding what should be done next is so useful that not long after your birth, your body comes to consider it utterly essential and to depend on it. Consciousness is your DNA and bloodstream and nerve cells and gut putting on a puppet show together, and they need a director so badly they create one out of thin air, the self, by the process that is the backwards of denial. If any part of the cast or crew loses the illusion of self for too long, all die. The same kind of reverse denial on a societal scale can produce religion for similar reasons. Without it, all die. That's why meditation is never going to be really popular. Most people would rather die than stop thinking even for a few moments, because deep down they equate the two. When the ceaseless monkey chatter of the mind becomes oppressive, they just turn on the TV or play some MP3s to drown it out. But basically, the mind exists because all the various parts of the body believe it does. That goes for both the subconscious and the conscious mind, and also for the body mind even below that, the part that would remember what side you like to sleep on and how to play your favorite instrument and where your genitals are located, even if the brain were removed, okay? Somehow, kneeling there in the forest in the dark with Oxy's head on my thighs while my conscious mind was tearing itself apart trying to send solace to my Oksana, somehow my subconscious mind or my body mind or both knew it wasn't going to work, and somehow they intuited the only thing that would and knew there was no time to hesitate. Yes, that's right. You remember what I said that night in your living room, standing over Alan Campbell's corpse. I made his selves disbelieve in himself. That's what I did to my Oksana. I can't tell you how. I don't know. And if I did, there are no words. If it helps to think of it as pulling memory cores from HAL 9000, be my guest. In some manner, I dispersed the communications between all those interlocking systems, disintegrated them, made each doubt the existence of Oksana Bescher, their self. She ceased. She was gone in less than a second, I think. It is possible to feel infinite regret and infinite relief in the same instant, to be grateful to the universe in the moment of despair, to be ashamed of being proud and proud to be ashamed. Incredibly enough, it is even possible to experience those paradoxes while running full tilt through the forest in the dark. What I had done for Oksana was mercy, and at the same time it felt like ultimate obscenity, perhaps even original sin, not to lust for forbidden knowledge, but to forbid knowing. Paradox generated more paradox. With all my heart, I wanted to go directly to hell and stay there. I felt I deserved to. And at the same time, I never stopped being aware that a demon from hell was coming for me, specifically to take me to that very place where I would spend my life being used for disgusting purposes by the man who had killed Oksana's body. I agreed I had that coming, but that didn't mean I accepted it. The moment the last particle of her existence, of her essence, departed from this plane of existence, I pushed her head off my lap like an old pair of gloves she wouldn't be needing anymore, took off her backpack and slung it over my shoulder, got to my feet, and started running. If I had wasted as much as a whole minute mourning, I think Agent Pitt would have had me that night. It was that close. He must have had to come some distance. How could he know my range wasn't as long as a few miles? But he came fast. When his alarms went off, he must have rolled out of bed and hit the ground running. What saved me was he knew Woodscraft, knew the area well, and was extremely physically fit, and I was clueless and totally out of shape. He had trained to hunt other wolves, not cows. Nothing I did made sense to him. He came close enough for me to read him, for maybe a minute. I've spent every minute since then running from him. Almost 40 years now. Now I'm going to go out for a short walk to check a few security arrangements and let you process this.
I was grateful for his tact. There certainly seemed to be a lot to process, and it's easier to process stuff of that level of profundity without anyone looking over your shoulder. I sat there thinking a dozen thoughts at once, feeling a dozen emotions at once, while he got up and left. Some monitor component of my mind noted how the door was open from the inside and stored the information. A minute or two later, my mouth, I think it was my mouth, caused me to get up and go make yet another cup of coffee. I was halfway to the kitchen end of the room when I stopped in my tracks. That's how long it took for it to hit me, for the implications to sink in, for it to dawn on me why Zudi had thought I might need some time to process his story. nearly 10 years earlier. At her request, I had helped my wife Susan end her life. I had been with her, done what was necessary. When her body died, I felt it happen. And then I'd sat beside her for half an hour or so, taking what comfort I could from the knowledge that her suffering was over, telling myself that now it was finally all right for me to be selfish and given to self-pity, go indulge in some exhilarating, stupid, self-destructive behavior for a while. And all the while, if Zudi was right, my beloved lay beside me, utterly helpless, totally terrified, absolutely alone, for an hour or 100 million years, in that range. Thanks to me. My son Jesse had never forgiven me for that act. I'd only really managed it myself in the last 4 years or so. I dropped the coffee cup. It landed on my bare left foot, hurting me so much I nearly noticed, and skittered crazily away across the floor. I turned around and went back to my chair and sat down and stared at electric fire on the laptop for half an hour or so without moving, until I had finished rewriting the story of my life to date in light of the new information I now had, in a way that would let me continue. I think I sang to myself from time to time, but don't remember what songs. Oddly, it never occurred to me to drink any of the brandy in the bottle sitting next to the computer. The moment I had the ridiculous thought that perhaps I should go yell out the door that it was okay to come back now, Zudi came back in with an armload of firewood, opened a thigh-tall bin with a foot pedal, dropped in the wood, and lowered the lid again. I didn't see a wood stove anywhere, but did see several areas where one could be concealed. And when I thought about it, he'd have been a fool to depend on electricity here on Coveney, no matter how he was getting it, which I also didn't understand. Hell, on Heron Island we lived with blackouts at least a dozen days out of every year, and often much longer. And BC Hydro was aware we were paying customers. He brushed wood debris from his bare chest, got a pitcher of cold water and clean cups, brought them over, and sat by me.
"Have you ever read Heinlein?" he asked me.
"Name rings a bell."
"Dead science fiction writer, considered the first grandmaster of that genre."
I nodded politely. "I'm colorblind in that range. Sorry. Strange or something?"
"In a strange land, yes. Among many other achievements, some of his stories inspired the development of cryonics, freezing dead people in hope of future resurrection."
"To tell you the truth, I always kind of wished I had the kind of money it takes to make that bet," I said. "I mean, sure, it's lousy odds, but look at the payoff." He nodded, but oddly as if I'd said something very sad.
"Well, one of the first cryonics firms offered him a free freeze to thank him. Heinlein turned them down and wouldn't say why. Drove them crazy. After his death, it turned out exactly one of his friends had had the nerve to ask him why he would reject even a long shot at extended life when it was free."
"Okay, Mr. Bones, what did he say?" I said, trying to lighten things up.
Zudi's voice was as bleak as if he'd been delivering a death sentence.
"He said, 'How do I know it wouldn't interfere with rebirth?'"
"Oh. Oh." Suddenly I saw what he was driving at. "Oh, wow." He spoke with his head down, absurdly as if he were addressing his penis.
"I have no opinions about what happens after death. Maybe we go to the Christian heaven, and if we've been good, get to spend eternity in a drab white robe playing the harp without food or drink or sex, content to adore the guy who invented pain and aging. Maybe we go to the Muslim paradise and spend eternity getting smashed with inexperienced lovers and adoring the same guy played by a different actor. Maybe we reincarnate Buddhist style or Hindu style or New Orleans style. Anybody who says he knows is lying or crazy."
Again, I made a feeble attempt at levity. "Or dead." He looked up. The pain in his eyes was shocking.
"Whatever happens, how do I know I didn't fuck it up for Oxy? Hey, Zudi, man, come on. I'm pretty sure what I did to her never happened to anyone before. Certainly not as often as people get hit by meteorites. There can't be a protocol for it in the system. Come on, brother, what about the most likely answer, okay?" "What's that?"
The question was exasperating.
"That nothing happens, that we don't go anywhere when we die. We just end and are gone from everywhere but human memory, and as James Taylor said, life goes on without us all around us. That you fucked up nothing, that all you did was shorten a really horrible last moment for someone you love. You stupid fat bastard, I should only be so lucky as Oxy was. I wish to God you'd been there for Susan."
He gaped at me, looking more than ever like Baby Huey.
"Jesus Christ," I said, "nobody ever looks as hard for anything as a person looking for something to feel guilty about."
He got a quizzical look, and then his features began to relax. The pain started to leave his face.
"Thank you, Russell,"
he said. My own irritation was gone. "You're welcome."
You really think that's the most likely answer?
Well, it seems to be the one with the least amount of wishful thinking in it.
Maybe so. I've always felt it was the least likely answer myself. I mean, I see the flaws in all the other ones. I just have trouble persuading myself that A, random chance produced matter, music, and Oksana's eyes, and B, that none of them matters at all.
I know what you mean, I agreed. Substitute Susan's eyes for Oxy's, and I'm right with you. But see, I want those things to matter, with roughly equal intensity, so my opinion is suspect.
Doesn't make it wrong.
Makes it suspect. He sighed.
I don't disagree.
And I'll tell you the truth, in a way it's an answer I prefer. I mean, I don't think I want to spend eternity in Catholic heaven, even if Susan is there, or to learn to read the Koran in Arabic, or stop eating beef or pork, or enter the void, or any of that crap. Beautiful, brief flickers in the darkness that the universe was too dumb to cherish. I can live with that.
I hear you, my friend, he said. But isn't that a hell of a thing to be the outcome you prefer?
He had me. Yes, it is. I finished the water in my cup and replaced it with brandy. I wish someone would invent a sane religion.
I'm working on it, he said.
Go, cat, go.
But there is more pressing business before the house.
The brandy hit me. Yeah, I'm coming back up to speed now. You figure it was Agent Pitt who took out Nika's cousin.
I can't think of anyone else alive, assuming he's alive, who would both be capable of following a non-existent link to Nika all the way to your house and interested enough to bother after all these years. The CIA has been out of the ESP business for over 30 years now.
Okay, you've been in his head. You know more about how he thinks than I do. What do you think he'll do now?
Dig around until he finds a really good handle on Nika or you or both of you, then squeeze you hard.
Is that his best move?
Yes, think about it. He wants to capture a telepath. He knows I'm almost as smart as he is. There's no way he's going to sneak up on me, on my home turf, even if he can find out where that is. He needs to get one of you to call me up or email me and sucker me into a preset trap he can spring from well outside my range. Tricking you into it is too complicated, and how can he be sure he's succeeded? Easier and more reliable to hold some kind of metaphorical gun to your head.
Jesus Christ and a teddy. And my son is somewhere on the same fucking island with him. I gulped more brandy. It didn't help enough. Then I saw the faint smile on Zudi's face.
I'm almost as smart as Agent Pitt, he said softly. And I know he's coming for me. And he doesn't know I know.
You have a plan.
Well, the beginnings of an outline of one, yes.
Tell me more, I started to say. But just at that moment, a penny dropped in my head, and I suddenly remembered something. Something horrible. I opened my mouth, tried to speak, failed. It didn't matter, of course. Zudi went just as pale as I must have done.
Oh, God, Russell, that's bad, he breathed. You really fucked up.
That's the end of Chapter 9 of Very Hard Choices by Spider Robinson. I do hope you will run to your local bookstore and score a copy of the Bane hardcover already on the shelves. And in the fullness of time, Eastern Press, I understand, will be bringing out one of those limited edition signed leather-bound jobbies if your budget runs to that. That's a full lid. I'll be back next Friday with Spider on the Web number 46. I'd like once again to thank all of you who have subscribed or made a donation or sent encouraging mail to spiderweb@shaw.ca. Now let's both go find some helpless victim and see if we can make him smile.
Hey, it's a thingy! A fiendish thingy!